Thought. There's one line left, and if we can't get through that, we have some serious trouble. So we're going to finish it tonight, and then we have a little discussion that goes with it by the time we're done with this last stanza of it, and then we'll move on to some more discussion of more a New Testament doctrine of prayer, some other types of questions that are prayer-related but different focus altogether starting next week. The last line of the Lord's Prayer is the one that may not even be in some of your translations, depending on kind of what you have. The "Thine is the kingdom and power and the glory forever, amen," is a textual variant that's not in some substantial manuscripts, so there's some suspicion about that. It is present in one of the earliest one of the earliest Christian books other than the New Testament that we have. What's called the Didache is a late 1st or very early 2nd century worship manual, descriptive of church life, and it has the Lord's Prayer in it, which I'll talk about here in a little bit, and it includes the line in question. So we don't know if that was the first place it ever showed up, and then Bible scribes from that time forward said, well, that's not the way it is in Didache, and added it to Matthew, or if it was originally in Matthew and got lost, but Didache had it, and so they said, oh, well, of course it is, and they put it back in. Don't know. But it's certainly a reasonable line, and traditionally it's the way the prayer has been said, so I thought we would say a few words about it. The statement itself anchors that prayer and trust in the authority, power, and purpose of God. So what I like about the phrase is that the prayer ends where it began. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done. All centered on God. And then the next few petitions were centered on the needs of self and of others. And then it ends back with the glory of God. Why might it be important to have a prayer that began and ended with the glorification of God? Why might that be important to us? There is no amount of silence that will make me feel awkward. I will keep on staring at you. Why might that make us, what might that do to us if we consistently prayed with God's glory at the front and the end of all of our prayers? Absolutely. That's exactly it. That hopefully, by putting the glory of God at the beginning and the end of the prayer, you are shaping what's in between, which is your own requests. It's really hard to be selfish and self-serving if you have to start and finish your prayer with a statement about God's glory and how it's not all about me and it's about Him, right? It's really hard to say, God, I want you to have all the glory. Now give me everything I want. You get all the glory, amen, right? I mean, that's a really hard prayer to say. So it helps to remind us, start and finish, what we're supposed to be doing. And if you make that a regular part of your prayer life, again, whether it's the Lord's Prayer or just your own personal prayer that's kind of modeled after it, you start and end with the glorification of God, it starts to shape the way that you pray in a certain way. You say it often enough, you're going to start believing it. You're going to start thinking that way. And so it's a training mechanism. It trains us how to think about our prayers, that every time we're going to start and end with God, and that's very important. One text I read said the most important word in that last stanza is thine. Thine is the kingdom, not mine is the kingdom. That everything in this prayer and everything in this universe and everything in everything belongs to Him and not to me. Self-centeredness is the opposite of the Lord's Prayer. So the prayer ends with, all of this belongs to you. Repeat what I said last week. The Lord's Prayer is not a magical incantation by which you say these special words and you bend God's will down to do whatever you want. the ending of it rules that out completely in case there was any doubt. The prayer is designed for you to help direct your thoughts to God and to ask that His will be done in your life, and then to specify ways in which you need help doing that. But definitely, it all goes back to the glorification of God. Any questions or comments on the thine is the kingdom business there at the end? It's pretty straightforward. Okay. So what then do we do with the Lord's Prayer? I poked around some of the various resources I had and had some interesting thoughts. I didn't bring my little green prayer book. I did order some more, the Lord Teach Us to Pray books. I ordered, I think, 10 more because there were a few that didn't get one. So I'll have those probably next week. But in the section on this last line, it comments that the Lord's Prayer is a prayer to pray when you don't know what else to pray. That it's a pretty good filler when you're completely lost. And that's not a bad idea. The place where you hear this most from people is in hospitals. People that just, they have no idea what else to say. It's all been said. And so they say, you know, what do I pray? And you'll hear them. Longtime Christians who maybe never made use of it before find themselves staring Psalm 116 in the face, right? The pangs of Sheol have encompassed me, and they start saying the Lord's Prayer because they don't know what else to say. And it works for that, right? It's not a prayer, God, work a miracle and save me. It doesn't say that. It just says, God, your will be done on earth as is in heaven. That's a pretty good hospital prayer when you don't know what else to ask for. So that's a time you hear it a lot. Calvin describes it like this. He says, the words may be utterly different, yet the sense ought not to vary. And what he means by that is when you pray, your words may be completely different from the Lord's Prayer, but what you're saying should never be different from the Lord's Prayer. That at the end, if you look at your prayer and hold it next to the Lord's Prayer, you should say, yep, that's what I said. In different words. But the sense of that prayer is what you're trying to accomplish. And it may take you a long time to say that or a short time to say that. You might sum it all up and thy will be done. And that might be your prayer. As we'll learn in the Psalms, there's sometimes you pray for a long time and sometimes you pray for a short time. So there are long songs and short songs. Psalm 117 is two whole verses. Psalm 119 is 22 stanzas. Sometimes you need 22 stanzas, and sometimes you need two verses. Okay. So in your own personal prayers, you'll make use of this in different ways. But what I would like to encourage you to do is more intentionally, on purpose, model your prayers after this one. Say, how can I make my prayer more like this one? What elements are in it that Christ wanted me to copy? So you say, well, I don't want to say it verbatim. That's fine, you don't have to. What elements, what was he trying to teach us with that prayer? It's obviously important. What did he want us to learn from it? And still start thinking about that. Well, how did he start his prayer? How do I start my prayer? How does he address God in this prayer? How do I address God in my prayer? What kind of things did he ask for personally? What kind of things do I ask for personally? And then that sense of things, I think, is very clear and important. Keller says it a different way, but it's the same. The Lord's Prayer must stamp itself on our prayers, shaping them all the way down. So it's, in a sense, kind of like a cookie cutter, only not, because you still get to use your own words, right? You get to decide how to say it, but that model should shape the way that you do it. What is a model? I mean, we call it the model prayer sometimes. What is a model? How does a model work? If you're in car manufacturing and they hand you a model and say, build this, what changes are you allowed to make and what changes are you not allowed to make with a model? If you bring him back a bicycle, you fail the test. I mean, that's just not what you were told to do. That's not the model, right? And so clearly, whether you look at the Model T or the cars in our parking lot, you see certain features that say, that's a car. And 100 years from now, you still say, that's a car, or it's not. I mean, there's certain things that make it a vehicle. That's what works. In fact, it goes back before that, before Model T to horse-drawn carriage. You say, that's a carriage. That's what it looks like. This has four wheels. These are where the people sit. There are certain elements that just work, and that's what needs to be in every one of them. And yet, you look in our parking lot, no two are identical. Every one of you is going to have a little different model of vehicle and different features that were important to you, and it's personal to you. It's a personal choice. You didn't ask me when you went and bought your car. I didn't get invited to the car lot to pick it out for you, because it was personal. It was your choice. It would be weird if someone else picked it out for you. Okay. So that's the sense of it. That stamp ought to be on it. You ought to be able to look at it, look at your prayer, look at the Lord's prayer, and they ought to be the same kind of thing. It ought to be recognizably a Christian prayer. Now, this is not true if you compare it to world religions. You take a Islamic prayer and compare it to the Lord's Prayer, and you'd say there's something's not like the other, right? There are some substantial differences in the way a Muslim prays at certain times of day and the Lord's Prayer. I mean, they're noticeably different. They're not the same kind of thing at all. But hopefully, a Christian prayer, no matter who says it, would sound like the same kind of organism, the same creature as the Lord's Prayer. Bonhoeffer, who's one of my heroes, German theologian. I learned something about him the other day. I'll share before I get to this quote. How important is prayer? Bonhoeffer was in Germany during World War II, and I knew this much. He was arrested by the Nazis and put into a prison camp, and ultimately executed just before the end of the war. I mean, just very shortly before he would have been released by the Allies, he was put to death in World War II. What I didn't know was what was the charge. I just assumed it was something generic, like they didn't like him. But it turns out the specific charge that he was charged with in World War II, he had published a book on prayer, and the Nazis deemed it sedition. That it taught the teaching of the New Testament on prayer so forcefully that the Nazis considered it a challenge to the authority of the regime to pray like that. And that was what he went to jail for and ultimately died for, was writing a book on prayer. So anyway, an interesting guy. And Bonhoeffer believed that the Lord's Prayer could be connected very strongly to the Psalms. If you were to take all, let me just read a statement. It would not be difficult to arrange all of the Psalms according to the petitions of the Lord's Prayer. We should need to change only slightly our arrangement of the sections. I mean, what he's trying to say is, all the basic concepts that you have in 150 Psalms, you will find that concept present somewhere in the Lord's Prayer. The Lord's Prayer is just this perfectly succinct version of everything you could find from all the different ends of the spectrum in 150 Psalms. Now, the only part I would disagree with, it would not be difficult. I actually spent some time the other day thinking, I wonder how you would go about doing that. I don't think it would be easy. But he says, it'd be easy. Yeah, you just take the Psalms and you arrange them and it looked just like the Lord's Prayer. But I do agree with his overall point that it is a summation of everything God's people had been taught about prayer. If you could compress all 150 Psalms into seven stanzas, it would sound like this, a perfect model of how a person prays. That would be what we expect from Jesus, of course. How did the early church make use of this prayer? That was another question I had, because, of course, we're restoration people. We want to restore New Testament Christianity and do whatever the early church did. The New Testament doesn't tell us a whole lot. There's only one verse that gives us a hint. Church history is also kind of vague on this point. At some point, it becomes very important for people to know the Lord's Prayer, but how early that is, it's kind of hard to say. Let me just give you the information as I have it. If you've got your Bible, turn to Acts 2:42. And I'm going to have two people read this. I want someone who does not have an English Standard Version to read Acts 2:42, and then someone who does have an English Standard Version, hopefully that's not just me, to read Acts 2:42. Someone who doesn't have that first, Acts 2:42. Zach, you have what, New King James? Yeah, go ahead. And in prayer is the way that's worded. Okay, that's the way I learned it growing up. Who has the ESV? Debbie, go ahead. And the prayers. Does anybody else have "and the prayers" at the end? What does the New American Standard have there, Rosalie? And to prayer. Is it prayer or prayers? Prayer. Okay. It's just a subtle little difference that didn't even catch my attention until somebody pointed out to me. The ESV is being really picky about the Greek text. The Greek text has an article, and it's plural. It doesn't say, "and they prayed." It says, "they dedicated themselves to the prayers." Now, what does that mean? I don't know that I know, which is apparently why most of the translations have said, we don't know what that means either, so we'll just say they prayed, and to prayer. But the text, in kind of a weird little phrase, says, "and to the prayers." In the same way that it says, "and to the breaking of the bread." Now, even the ESV doesn't do that. The Greek text is emphatic here. This isn't just they had some bread and said a prayer. They showed them how to break the bread and say the prayers. What does that sound like to you? It sounds like, you know, communion or worship, the kind of thing. These we have the bread. They weren't having dinner. They were breaking the bread and they were saying the prayers. So some have taken that to mean maybe early Christian disciples were taught model prayers. How do you teach someone to be a Christian? What do you start with? Do they want to know how to pray? These folks had been saying Jewish prayers their whole life. Did they need to learn a few new ones? Might they have been taught the Lord's Prayer? Maybe. So anyway, that's just one of the passages in the New Testament that, and it's the only one I can find that even hints that they might have been taught specific words of prayer. If you're in Acts, look in Acts chapter 3 and verse 1. Now Peter and John were going up to the temple at the hour of prayer, the ninth hour. And some have connected that they had certain times of worship. And so there were hours of prayer that they learned. So now you're a Christian. This is the day of the week we take the Lord's Supper. These are the hours of the day we go up to the temple and pray. Maybe that's what they taught them. It's really hard to say, but it's interesting. What I want to emphasize, regardless of what we do with the Lord's Prayer in that verse, is that one of the first things you were taught as a disciple was how to pray. That was mandatory to start participating with the early church. You had to know how to break the bread, communion, and how to pray. The reason I bring that up, how many of you have ever attended a new converts class at some point in your life? How many of you ever taught a new converts class? Yeah, done some of those, okay. Do we put prayer in there as one of the things that this is one of the things? I got 13 weeks or whatever, how many lessons I've got, and I've got to tell you everything there is to know about Christianity in however many lessons. Is prayer one of our... I'm just curious, I don't know. Did you have a lesson on that? That's something you used? Good. I don't know if that's normal or not, but clearly in the early church, first thing you're going to learn how to pray with us. Because that was part of their life. And it seems like maybe the Lord's Prayer would have been used for that teaching. Maybe not. Didache is the text I referenced earlier. Again, it's a late 1st century or early 2nd century text. It's not in the New Testament. It's not supposed to be. It's not a missing book or something. It's just a manual. We have those books that kind of teach you how to do things. So, well, I'll give you an example. When someone is baptized here, we still to this day hand them a copy of Leroy Brownlow's Why I Am a Member of the Church of Christ, which is the most commonly and oft republished book in Church of Christ history, I was told the other day. Okay, it's a very well-known book, and it's the book that we hand people and say, well, start here, read this. Okay, Didache was kind of this book. It wasn't scripture, but it was somebody they trusted saying, well, this is kind of what we do. Some of it sounds just like Christianity as you know it. Some of it does not. Some of it you read and you say, I have no idea where they got that idea. But all of it's very interesting. The verse right before this one talks about fasting. And I'm trying to remember exactly how it goes, but it's something like, hypocrites pray on Monday and Wednesday, or fast on Monday and Wednesday, so you make sure you fast on Tuesday and Thursday. You know, just sounds like an absurd thing to have in a book. But somebody was worried about it, so somebody wrote it down. These are the days we fast. But then it talks about how they prayed. And it says, and do not pray as the hypocrites, but as the Lord commanded in his gospel, pray thus. And then it recites the entire Lord's Prayer in the text, right out of Matthew, with the added bit at the end, "For thine is the power and the kingdom," and so forth. And then it says at the end, "Pray thus three times a day." So the earliest manual we have that was not part of the Scriptures for early Christians encouraged them to pray the Lord's Prayer three times a day, again, as a way to get to know it. If you want to learn something, how do you learn it? You don't do it once and move on. If you want to learn something, you repeat it. And so they were told, pray this three times a day, and this is how you get started. And then I assume they were taught, like these other Christian writers we've read, that you can now branch out with your own words and say this now that you've learned to pray. But this is how they were taught early on. Learn this prayer first. This is a good starting place to do this. This is the way you teach anything, isn't it? If you teach somebody how to swing a baseball bat. Now, what's the right way to swing a baseball bat? Whichever way hits the ball is the right way. I mean, if you hit the ball, if you're batting 330, nobody cares how you do it. Okay? But there are ways that are more standard than others. And when you get your little league kids out there, one of my favorite baseball players ever was Chuck Knoblauch. You don't teach a six-year-old to bat like Chuck Knoblauch because he batted like an insane person, and he held the bat all crooked and everything. That works for him, and that's great, but it doesn't work for anybody else. So you don't show them that. You show them something very normal and say, do this, and you nitpick them, don't you? You say, no, get your elbow up just like this. You sit, you put your feet just exactly this far apart. When they turn pro, they can do it however they want. But while they're little, you say you do it exactly like this. Same thing with learning to write. How'd your teacher teach you how to write? Here's your big chief tablet, and here's your pencil. You make an A just like this. How many of you are allowed to say, you know, I kind of like my A's like this? That was a good way to get hit with a ruler, wasn't it? Right? No, you made the A however she said make the A. Now, when you get to become a professional writer, you do whatever you want. Nobody corrects how Stephen King writes his A's, right? Nobody cares. But when you're learning how to write, you do it that way. And that seems to be what they used the Lord's Prayer for in the early church. When you became a Christian, they said, here's a good prayer. Start with this. Say it just like this three times a day. And then, as I'm going to show you in a second, it seems like they were told to grow in that. Now, what would happen? Do some people fail to grow? I suspect there were some people, maybe a lot of people, who never got past the Lord's Prayer, who to the day they died only ever said that prayer and never bothered trying to kind of grow in it. And that's maybe where we get a lot of the ritual that came down through the years of people saying it over and over again. It could be simply that that was what they were taught, and so they stuck with it. But here's a couple of other statements. Justin Martyr has a book called Apology, which is from 155 A.D., and he's talking about how Christians worship. And he says, you know, every church service has a president. Did you know our church service had a president? You didn't know that, did you? Okay. Well, it's a misleading word. It's the person presiding over the assembly. So somebody's up front is what he meant. Someone is up front leading the assembly. Okay, now that sounds normal. So the presiding person of the assembly should, quote, offer prayers and thanksgiving according to his ability. Now, that's not very specific at all, is it? He doesn't say, you better say the Lord's Prayer exactly. It doesn't sound like Didache that spells out. Didache goes on in the next stanza to tell you what prayer to say for the communion and what words to say and how to do it exactly, you know, because it's a manual. But Justin Martyr says, well, you hope you have a mature person who gets up and lead the worship, and they say a prayer according to their ability. And then there's a text that's even later than this that's called the Apostolic Tradition. It's not written by any apostle, but that's just the name of it. And it says, it is not altogether necessary for the prayer leader to recite the very same words which we gave before, as though studying to say them by heart in his thanksgiving to God. But let each one pray according to his own ability. If indeed he is able to pray suitably, typo there, with a grand and elevated prayer, this is a good thing. But if, on the other hand, he should pray and recite a prayer according to a brief form, no one shall prevent him. Only let his prayer be correct and orthodox. So by the time you get to the 3rd or 4th, 5th century, this is kind of normal. This sounds even familiar to us. Okay, someone gets up and leads a prayer, and they do it according to their ability. Do they have to recite a particular prayer? No. Would it be a problem if they did? If it were a scriptural, or as he says, correct and orthodox prayer, would anybody get mad that they led the same one every time and they knew it and they were okay with it? I can't imagine that we would if we're going to chastise someone for not being creative enough. They wrote it down, it worked once, it'll work tomorrow. So he says it would be ideal for a mature person to get up and say a prayer according to his ability and not like he's taking a test. That's what the impression I get is that's what young Christians do. Young Christians just repeat the forms we taught you earlier. He says, that's good that you learned that. But when we call on somebody to lead prayer, they get up and say the prayer according to their ability. But if not, as long as it's correct and orthodox, don't pester them. If you get up and say a prayer to Satan, you and I are going to have a conversation afterward. But if you say the same prayer every time and it's the right kind of prayer, God bless you. There's a lot of people who won't get up and do that. As James finds out every Sunday, right? The number of people who are willing to get up and do is always shorter than we wish. Okay. So with the 10 minutes I've got left, I wanted to have some discussion on this kind of general topic. In Luke 11:2, Jesus says, when you pray, make use of this prayer. So my question for us is, how are our typical prayers like the Lord's Prayer? I mean, are we doing a good job? If you held up the prayers that were said this morning or this evening to the Lord's Prayer in Matthew chapter 6, verses 9 through 13, would you say, yeah, that was kind of the same sort of thing? Or would you say, no, that's dramatically different? All right, question two, how are our typical prayers different from the Lord's Prayer? Are we leaving something out that we ought to put in? Are we putting some things in that we ought to leave out that Jesus didn't bother with? Are there other differences? And then a third question, I just thought these are just discussion questions. How can we make better use of the Lord's Prayer? Again, I'm not suggesting an arcane and mundane repetition of that like a incantation, but using it as he intended, as an instructive tool. What can we do, whether it's with new converts or our children or with ourselves, to make sure that we're listening to what Jesus said about prayer when we pray? Those are my three questions. And you're welcome to start wherever you want. And yes, I will stare awkwardly at you until you do. Zach. Good man. That's why I was staring at you.
Number two, how are our typical prayers different from the Lord's Prayer?
Yes.
I think sometimes we jump into particulars. For example, the sick. We might
Yeah. So that is a difference. And again, I'm just asking you to point out differences. I'm not saying that's good or bad. That is a difference. Jesus' prayer is very short and very generic, which is what you would expect from a model, right? If Jesus said, pray for Ellie Mae, then for 2,000 years, people would have been praying for Ellie Mae, right? I mean, they would verbatim. And so instead, you know, he doesn't use specific. But we tend to. Do we sometimes use too many specifics? There was a beloved brother back in Wetumpka when my dad preached there named Darwin, and he sometimes used his prayers as a public address bulletin, and it was time for him to explain the news of the day. Lord, please take care of Debbie, who's my sister's cousin, who, as you remember, married that one fella she shouldn't ever been with, but now she is sick and in the hospital from that disease she got from Uncle Edward. He had it at Thanksgiving, and he shouldn't have ever come. He should have stayed. And it was this prayer that was, you know, the news of the day contained in a prayer, probably an unnecessary amount of detail, right? Jesus' prayer is definitely succinct. Darwin's funniest prayer ever was one day when I filled in for Dad and said, Lord, thank you for the good lesson today. It was good to hear a good prayer for or a good lesson for a change. And then realized what he had said and said, sorry about that. I'll go out the back door. Amen. That was how he prayed. So he was very candid in his prayers. Whatever was in his brain is what came out of his mouth. Lovely man. What else? Good thought, Zach. Or we could start there. Let me ask, what about the length of our public prayers? Should we look at the prayer of Jesus and say it is pretty short and take that as important? Or should we say that's just a place to start and then you pray as long as you want? As I mentioned in the Psalms, it varies, doesn't it? There are very short ones and very long. And there's probably time for both. I went to a class at Seminole, like our boys, you know, are trained to lead prayers on Wednesday night. I did that at Seminole once upon a time, and I remember the elder who taught that saying, it does not have to be eternal to be supernal, was his rule of thumb. And he looked at me when he said that because he knew how my dad prayed. The only thing longer than dad's sermons were his prayers, and they were pretty robust, and they were powerful, but they were lengthy. And I think he was trying to tell me otherwise, this elder was. Again, I would say that there's not any clear, hard, and fast rule, but it is at least possible to say quite a lot in a short amount of space, isn't it? And Jesus teaches us that. A well-thought-out prayer can be fairly brief. James.
The Lord's Prayer seems kind of like a public prayer.
It does.
And it's very short.
Yeah.
John 17, much longer prayer, but that's a very personal prayer.
Yeah, that's a good thought. John 17 is a much more personal prayer of Jesus, and it is very lengthy, full chapter length. This is just a couple of verses. Luke's version is even shorter. So it could be that public prayer, I'm not pouring out my heart to God. I am speaking for all of us, and that's a different kind of prayer. And it might be good for them to have a certain duration that can keep everyone's attention. We can follow it and pray it and then kind of reach its conclusion. Maybe. Yes?
But for number three, I like using the Lord's Prayer as an outline.
Okay. How so? Tell me more. And now I'm going to put you on the spot. When you pray, when you use the Lord's Prayer as a kind of an outline, is that something you do before you get up if you know you're going to have a prayer? Or is that something you know so well that you can get up and say, all right, here's my outline and I can go through it?
If I ever try to do something ad hoc or just spontaneously, I make a mess of it. So I always
scribble some notes. Yeah. I think that's good, and we try to get the service rotation of who says the prayers when online before the beginning of the month for the whole month. So in theory, our fellows who lead prayers could be aware of it if they chose to and give it some thought the day or week before they got up. And that would be a good habit to again, you don't have to verbatim write out every word you're going to say, of course, but to think, okay, how's the Lord's prayers go? What kind of things should be in my prayer? What might it need to sound like? And then there might be some other things you'd include. More or less, depending on the situation. Yeah. Other thoughts? Got about a minute left. Debbie?
I think whenever that kind of what Zach was talking about, how are our prayers different, when we have had situations within our congregation, certain members that are in need of our prayers, I think that has been a hugely important thing that our elders have chosen to do, because I think when you're praying for that,
yeah.
As you are doing a specific prayer for that particular situation.
So if a person comes forward and tells us they have cancer and they just found out and they want the prayers of the congregation, it wouldn't be wrong for someone to say the Lord's Prayer, because again, I'm going to say it's not ever wrong to say it, but is there a more fitting thing you could say that addresses specifically the needs of that person? Yeah. In fact, it would, if Bill got up after someone said that and said the Lord's Prayer, we might think he just wasn't paying attention, right? Didn't you just hear what she said? Not that it was a bad prayer, just did you hear this need? And so, yeah, in prayers that have specific connections like that, specific connections have specific prayers. Okay. All right, thanks for your attention. Appreciate it. And we'll come back to all that next week.